Welcome back to Dave's Gone By, and very excited and honored to be talking to a colleague and friend of mine for many years now, because we're both members of the American Theater Critics Association. This man has been reviewing theater and dance for nearly 50 years. He is also a retired professor of dramatic literature at State University of New York up in Geneseo, New York, and he's freelance now, but he previously wrote for a bunch of newspapers in the Gannett chain. He was the upstate New York critic for Dance Magazine for 25 years, and he's still going strong. His name is Herbert M. Simpson. I call him Herb. Welcome to the neighborhood, Herb Simpson. How you doing?
Okay, I guess.
Okay, you guess. I mean, let's start right there. I mean, as someone who was a theater critic based in Long Island and New York for many years, I used to see 5, 6, sometimes 7 shows a week, constantly running back and forth. Does it get tougher for you now that you're what? You're 81 years old to do that?
I'm now on August 2nd. I'll be 83.
Oh.
And so yes, it gets tougher, but I'm also cutting back. I mean, these days freelancing, I don't have to review seasons the way I did when I was the local dance critic or the local theater critic. And so I can avoid having to go look at upstate New York adolescent children playing 19th century middle-aged Russian Jews and Fiddler on the Roof. And it makes a difference not having to do that.
We're going to be talking about your going to the Stratford Festival this year up in Canada. You used to do the Shaw Fest as well. Have you given that up?
Yeah, I sort of have. After a while, when I stopped writing for newspapers and magazines and had to write for websites, which aren't as good for the box office, the Shaw Festival cut out my guest tickets and often didn't want me to go on the crowded opening night. And my reason for going there on the opening nights was to meet my old friends who were critics in Canada.
Oh.
So I've sort of given up on Shaw for a while. I may go back because they have an exciting new artistic director. But Stratford, I have seen virtually every major show they've done since about 1980.
Whoa. Wow.
And I started first. I first went there and was astounded at the level they were working at in 1964. So I go back with them. It's by far the best.
It's not a repertory company. What would you call it? It's an institutional theater, I guess.
Yeah, it's a classical repertory theater, but it also does musicals and new plays. It's the best one in the hemisphere. They have more than 600 of the best artists imported from the U.S. and elsewhere, and of course mostly Canadian, in residence there for many months, usually April to November.
What's interesting is, having seen shows at the Strat since 1964, and then, which by the way is the year I was born, and then since 1980, seeing their whole seasons, it's cool that you say that this particular season has gotten off to a really strong start, even if I think you mentioned off mic that they're not really taking chances in terms of material so far.
Well, they have an amazing collection of artists living there. They have probably 3 world-ranking Hamlets, for instance, and my deceased longtime friend Brian McDonald really finally got his way and got them to train and bring in artists that they could train not only to be Shakespearean classical actors but singers and dancers to rival a Broadway gypsy in talent. They do just extraordinary work. There's nothing financed like that. There's no ensemble like that anywhere else in this hemisphere.
But this season, compared to like the last couple, are you seeing this one as being a notch even higher?
No, a notch even higher than a couple of years ago when it was, they had an amazing year. But it's never but so low. planned it slightly differently. There are now about 6 or 7 shows that I'll see in August that haven't opened yet. They include brand new work, never done before, and more experimental work.
Oh, okay.
But they opened with 7 blockbuster shows in a row, and every one of them was on Stratford's level, so it was beautifully done. I mean, there was nothing here that most of us haven't seen at least one or two of. There was a Twelfth Night, Romeo and Juliet, Guys and Dolls, HMS Pinafore, a musical of Treasure Island, The School for Scandal, and Simon of Athens, which is an offbeat Shakespeare play, but one that Stratford has a very special, impressive record for. When they first did it, they got a musician known as Duke Ellington to come up in residence and do the music for it, for instance.
Wow, and I think, and Brian Bedford, I guess, did it up there, and he brought it to Broadway many years later, too, and he was pretty wonderful in that.
Yeah, well, again, Brian, we just lost, and is one of the greatest actors ever, and always a very distinctive actor in whatever he did. So when he did Timon, suddenly Timon, who's a really very peculiar and almost hateful character at times, turned into something very charismatic indeed, and it was amazing.
Can I ask, Herb Simpson, what was your favorite show so far this year in all the Stratford lineup?
Oh, I think Guys and Dolls. It's an amazingly wonderful Guys and Dolls. I don't know how famous, trying to think of his name, the choreographer decided for Guys and Dolls is, and the director, Donna Fury.
Oh, okay. Who's the wife of
Fury.
Cole. Yeah.
Has an international reputation as a television star, movie star, as well as stage star. He is her husband.
Right.
She's starting to rival him because she has done some of the most brilliant reproductions and reconceptions. She got permission, actually the first time ever, to restage a chorus line 2 years ago. And she did it without the straight across line because Stratford has a very famous octagonal thrust stage.
Hmm.
And she put it on that and kept the general pattern of the choreography, but essentially redid it, and it was brilliant. New York Times, when I came up, saw it and raved about it. And then several years ago, I don't know how to say this, she did a Fiddler on the Roof that is perhaps the only absolutely perfect staging of a musical I've ever seen. But there was nothing that wasn't flawless about it. It had one of Stratford's great all-star casts, but also it was just perfectly, beautifully reconceived and restaged, and everybody I know who saw it was just absolutely bowled over by it. Unfortunately, it costs a lot more to tape, video tape, that is, a TV version of a musical than it does a play. Stratford has recently been recording and releasing some of its productions.
But they're not going to...
musical, because they cost a lot of money to do.
Yeah.
Very complicated.
Well, did they have at least even like a one-camera record of it, the way Lincoln Center's library does in New York for most shows?
Yeah, I think they do, but I don't know how available it is.
We're talking, by the way, with Herb Simpson, longtime theater and dance critic. I want to ask you about dance, because I've been, as I keep saying, a theater critic for almost 30 years myself, and I pretty much know how to write a theater review backwards and forwards. But I'm always flummoxed in the very rare time I've been asked to watch and write about dance, because there's no narrative there, usually. There's not acting, per se, and I don't know the grammar of how high an arm should go or a finger should lift in a particular move. How do you review a dance?
Well, that's why I got the work initially. I joined the theater critics several years later, but I was dance critic. I was one of the founding members of the Dance Critics of America. At one time, I was on their board, actually twice, and I even edited their newsletter. The point is that every sports writer thinks he can write theater critics, criticism.
Right.
Everybody thinks he can. But dance makes them nervous because it, you gave more sensible reasons, but actually what they're afraid of is the French terminology for ballet and whatnot. And the fact is, a good review wouldn't use that unless it was something absolutely extraordinary anyway, like Baryshnikov doing 18 perfect pirouettes on one preparation, and nobody else can do that, so you'd mention it and use the word pirouettes. But otherwise, it's the vocabulary, and the people who know it would find it very dull to read about what steps they were doing. And so really, all you have to do is describe what you saw, and any good writer of criticism can do that. Nonetheless, I had no trouble. I went to see a lot of things from the time I was, I don't know, 13. I don't know how I got the idea that my parents objected, because when I thought later of all the things I had seen by the time I was 20, how could a 13-year-old have gone to see all those shows and all those ballets and whatnot if his parents objected? I certainly couldn't have afforded the tickets. But I did go to see lots of things. I kept running into Bill Como, who founded Dance Magazine, the world's largest dance magazine, and now defunct After Dark, which was a theater magazine. I kept seeing him and talking to him at performances, and one day he said, "How would you like to write for me?" And that started it. And I was on that magazine's title page as upstate New York correspondent for 25 years. I did several cover stories. I even did an 18-page pullout cover story on Valerie Bettis, who was a wonderful actor, dancer, modern dancer, choreographer.
But I want to hammer this part home again, because I do get that a dance review almost has to be 80 to 90% just pure description. But how do you know if it's good or bad or boring or
I
not?
Think that's a matter of taste.
Okay.
I was able to do that because I had seen so much. I had seen ballet in Russia and in England and in France and in Denmark, my favorite company, the Royal Danish Ballet. I had seen it all over the country, and I'd seen most of the big famous modern dancers by the time I was, I don't know, 30-something. And I was lucky because I grew up in Baltimore, which was a tryout city. Ford's Theater was a famous pre-Broadway tryout. Kiss Me, Kate is set in Ford's Theater, Baltimore. We went out to the alley to see if the shipping dock looked like the Too Darn Hot number, and it didn't, but that's where it's set. And so I saw everybody at one time or another, and I'd seen so much dance. I don't know enough about the technique of dance to teach a good class, but I've seen hundreds of classes, and I've seen, I was lucky and had friends who took me backstage at the Bolshoi to watch rehearsals and things. I've seen so much dance that I was able to do comparative thinking about, you know, this woman isn't nearly as dazzling as Pasetskaya was, and so on.
So it's really about an accumulation of experience. I wasn't the theater critic that I am now when I started out in the late 1980s.
I think that's really it.
Yeah.
The most famous dance critics that I can think of were none of them dancers, and most of them weren't dance teachers.
Speaking
of people like Clive Barnes who could write.
Can I ask, Herb, since you mentioned teaching, let's veer to that for a little while, because you were a professor of dramatic literature at SUNY. Do you have any amazing anecdotes, any great memories of teaching dramatic lit?
Yeah. I don't even know where to start with that.
Oh, okay.
Geneseo, little college, doesn't have a distinguished drama department, but we've got about four people on Broadway now. And I have taught people like, I don't know if you know Bill Sadler. He's a superb actor who's done many Broadway shows and has done a number of films and has a TV show now, I forget what. He was one of a number of professional actors and others who have come through, and I was able to teach. Such an odd thing.
Yeah.
I've forgotten the boy's name now, but a high school kid came to see me. He really wanted to get into musical comedy. He was told to go to the college and talk to the guy who teaches theater appreciation and dramatic literature and whatnot. He may give you some ideas for an audition piece. So I worked out an audition piece for him of that wonderful speech that begins Act Two of House of Blue Leaves.
Hmm.
It's too long, so we cut it back a little. And he did that as his audition for a Boston Academy that has a specialty in musical comedy, and got in because they were tired of seeing the same old audition pieces, and he had this one, and even worked in a somersault. So he came back, in fact, made me a bundt cake to thank me for getting him in. And about a few years later, he came through with a touring national company of a musical. The most interesting, of course, was Albee. I did a course, just an early course, just on the plays of Edward Albee, and he eventually came to my college to talk and visited my class, and I had him over for dinner, and we became friends.
So,
I'm not a colleague.
Yeah, no, that's I did want to get into your longtime, you could say it was a friendship. It was more than just friend, cordial colleagues. You were friends.
Yes, I was not an intimate friend, and I was not a colleague.
Oh.
I was a friend. I have, I don't know, 50, 60 letters that he hand wrote to me, which are always fun to try to read because you should see his handwriting. We simply hit it off, and I became a diabetic a couple of years later and said something to Edward, and he sent me all this material, the whole diabetic, whatever it is, manual or something, I don't know how many pages, from Johns Hopkins, and chewed me out one time because I kidded about eating a lot of meals and saying that this is not anything to be...
Because you were taking your health for granted, I guess.
Yeah, but I got to read a lot of it. Occasionally he would send me a script before it was published. I really didn't do that much. I reviewed his plays when they played here, and I reviewed one or two in New York. I saw them all.
Well, did you ever feel that there was a compromise involved because you were reviewing plays by a friend?
No. No, because the plays are great plays, and I didn't always send him my reviews. If he was interested, I would. But as I say, it wasn't a professional relationship. We just kind of liked each other, and he was very kind and generous to me. When I went into New York, he would treat me to dinner and or brunch or something. Edward was an amazing man, and now I often get involved in Twitter and whatnot with people saying stupid things, like this character on the West Coast who wanted to make Nick in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf a black man, and Edward wasn't prejudiced, as this man suggests. Edward had okayed a black Martha in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf because there's nothing in that suggests that she isn't. But Nick is described consistently and often as a blue-eyed blonde, pretty boy.
Okay, but then let me do a little bit of devil's advocate here with you, Herb. What if there's a company, a theater company in Africa that wanted to do Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Would they not be able to do that? Because everyone in that cast would likely be black.
I don't know whether that's it's been done or not. I know there are some examples like that.
Would you stop theater companies in China or Japan doing Fiddler on the Roof, where everybody is Asian? Because they're going to be. You know, they're not going to be Jews from Russia. So, you know, it's a thought in this modern era.
You see, there's a difference there. If you're changing it so that we understand that a black company is doing it, and it's a black company's version, and it's all black, then you adjust to that, and you understand that it is not a realistic example of what the play is supposed to be, but it is an interesting version. I saw a great all-black Long Day's Journey into Night.
My first encounter.
Those are all described as very Irish people.
Exactly. My first encounter with Long Day's Journey was a television version that starred Ruby Dee and, I'm forgetting, unfortunately, some of the other names.
That's the one I saw, probably. The one, you're talking about Long Day's Journey?
Yes.
Yeah, it was Ruby Dee and...
The guy who played the grandpa on The Cosby Show. Was it Earl Hyman? Yeah, it was wonderful.
Hyman was perhaps our greatest classical actor. He did a major, well-received Hamlet, Macbeth, Lear.
But there you go. What if Shakespeare, in his time, would have said, wait, I can see a black man playing Othello, but Hamlet? Are you crazy?
Yeah, but this was Earl Hyman, and Earl Hyman also did Ibsen and Shakespeare and everything else, and he did them in English in the United States and England, in Danish in Denmark, in Swedish in Sweden, and in Norwegian in Norway, where he was knighted for his acting.
I'm just saying, couldn't there be someone
like
playing... but couldn't there be someone playing Nick, again, Devil's Advocate, who is not blonde, who is not blue-eyed, but just a great actor? You know, even if that goes against the quote-unquote stage directions.
I think it would confuse the play. Among other things, this is a couple that got together because of a false pregnancy. Now, as I understand it, his wife in this version would not have been played by a black woman.
Mm.
So you're raising all other issues in the relationship that aren't in the script. And I think it would really mess things up. As I said, Edward had okayed a black Martha, and that would have been a mixture. But there's nothing to indicate that she isn't.
Oh, fair enough. Let me ask you another question of something that I think I read pretty recently about Albee, is that he had other works that haven't been produced and stuff, and he wanted them burned upon his demise?
I'm very upset about that. I'm still writing people about it.
What do you feel about that? I think I would disobey his dying wish on that.
Well, other writers have done that. My problem is not with something like the last play he was working on, which was called Laying an Egg, and which he never really got together properly. And I think it would be probably a disservice to hang on to that, and I wouldn't mind that being burned. On the other hand, he wrote a play called The Lorca Play. Now, there's a certain fascination about a great, offbeat, controversial playwright from one country and one age writing a play about a great, controversial playwright from another country in another age. And I think, from all I heard from people who have seen it or who read it, it really has much to offer. I talked to the head of Stratford about doing it, former head. He's gone now. And he was intimidated by it. He said it was too long. It needed cutting badly. It had too many people in it. It had, however, he said, much that was beautiful and valuable. And so I should think it should be kept and studied. And what I thought of was Eugene O'Neill's Lazarus Laughed. That's a play that's been done twice.
Never heard of it. Wow. Okay.
Never. Well, it has a cast of about 150.
Okay. So the public theater can do it, but just about nobody else, yeah.
And it is, I don't know how long, but certainly 5 hours or more.
But you don't burn it. You don't make
its
demise.
It's got much in it that shows us things we didn't know about Eugene O'Neill as a poet.
Right. Exactly.
So it is valuable as literature, but not as a theater piece. And that's my feeling tentatively about the Lorca play, because the head of Edwards' estate told me that if I had told him I was looking for it, I told Edward, who said he was going to send me a copy, and he never did, he would have gotten me a copy. But now he's not one of the executors, and the executors are following what the will says, and so he can't get me a copy. People have read it. It was produced in a small production for a few days in Houston, Texas. It's not like no one knows what's in it. It's that it was never published, and now I'm afraid they're going to destroy it. Now, I would really like them to hang on to that, especially I'd like to read it and see if it really has things of great value in it as literature.
Yeah, but also I imagine if they did it, you know, in that reading thing, the actors involved somebody, the director kept a copy. So they can burn it, quote-unquote, but at least that something's going to be floating around somewhere.
Oh, yeah, I know it exists.
Yeah, as opposed to things that never got produced that are just in his drawer, like the laying an egg thing.
But I can't, oh yeah, that one I think should go.
But again, that's just your opinion. Some other critic might have a very different, no, it's not good yet, but boy, if you look at this passage, this gives us a whole new window, that sort of thing.
I suspect that that's...
not true.
I think an artist has a right to have some say about what his work, what should happen to it. It would be one thing if it had been released, and it was, as what's-her-name was, briefly, the Lorca play, and if there was some chance of getting to do it where it would be liked, but this is something that he was planning, and it didn't get done, and I think probably ought to get.
I don't know. I mean, the other side of it is every week on this radio show I do a Bob Dylan segment, because I love Bob Dylan's music, and the news about him was that a few months ago, they just were taking boxes and boxes of his old stuff, which he sold to this foundation for about $15 million. And it's everything from handwritten first drafts of songs to a line of a song on a piece of hotel stationery, and the song was never fully written. And it just all goes into this enormous archive. And who's hurt by that? That it's kept, and that people with white gloves on can go to a museum and just thumb through it if they want to. You know?
I'm mixed in my reaction to that. I don't know why an artist shouldn't have some more control than that.
Well, let me ask you more personally, Herb Simpson, since you've been a theater and dance critic for nearly 50 years at this point, what are you going to do with your stuff, your playbills, your dance playbills, your own clippings of all of your published reviews and stuff?
They're going to get thrown out, all of them, shortly, because they're incomplete and they don't make anything that's valuable. But one of my problems right now is sorting through a house that's a parody of Bachelor's Clutter, where every room has got boxes full of papers and whatnot, and they're not in any order, and I can't find things. Now, I have letters from Albee that I want to save, and I've got to go through and find them before I start wholesale throwing things out. But some of my stuff was thrown out when I was ill, and they had to restructure the first floor to make a place where I could sleep there, because my only toilet is on the second floor, and I couldn't walk up steps. And so I've lost a lot of stuff, and I have no complete. Nowhere is there a complete bibliography. And the stuff that I put on computer, I am told, they're so fouled up that they can't open the... So I'm stuck. And I'm thinking right now of, you know, getting rid of things. And every time I start looking through a box, I come across a letter from some wonderful person that I don't want to lose. I did, for Dan career, and I have programs that are really very interesting to me. I don't know whether they would be to anyone else.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Maybe before you just dump things wholesale, tell folks at the Lawrence and Lee Institute or maybe the New York Public Library that you've got this stuff and it's totally disorganized. But if they want to go through your boxes, God bless.
Oh, yeah. Well, I tried some of that, but it's just not what...
Ah, okay.
It can happen.
Okay. Let me...
I'm the only person who started reviewing Garth Fagan when he came here as a choreographer. He's the choreographer of...
Lion King, I think.
King. But he also has a great company that's gotten great reviews everywhere, and the Times and other papers have called him one of our seven greatest living modern dance choreographers. And I don't know that I can find all the things I've written about him, but I am one of the first people to ever write about him. And I have lots of stuff somewhere hidden among all these papers that are driving me crazy.
One or two more minutes we have with Herb Simpson, the theater critic. Besides that incredible Fiddler on the Roof that you mentioned from Stratford from a couple of years ago, what are your other two or three favorite things that you've ever seen? I'm a little more interested in theater, but it can be dance too.
You mean everything that I've ever seen?
Everything you ever, going back
I don't know where to start. I saw people like Myra Hess, who was a legend and came as an old lady to play the most beautiful Chopin I ever heard. I saw a number of very famous musicians who came over. See, the thing about living in Washington, where I moved to from Baltimore, is that everything comes there. If something came over from Russia and did one concert in New York and then went back, they still had to do one concert also in Washington because of the embassy. And I saw everything.
Wow.
I can't tell you how many legendary people, I don't know what cellists you've heard, but I've seen Casals and Piotrkowski. I saw any number of fascinating performances like that. Marian Anderson, two or three times.
Well, it's funny that the first things that are coming to your mind are music. What about theater?
Well, I saw the original production of Long Day's Journey into Night.
With Robards and...
It was...
Or was it Frederick March? No, wait, who was it? It was...
Lawrence Eldridge, right.
Oh, sorry, okay, yeah.
I started up the aisle after Act One, and in front of me, a man turned angrily to his wife and said, "This is no comedy."
Yeah. Because the title would lead you
to put in my review.
Yeah, because any play that's called Long Day's Journey into Night, I think laughs. So, Herb, turning this on its head then, what is, in your memory, the worst thing you've ever seen?
Oh, boy. I don't think I could do that anymore. I could do some of the worst, but
it'd
be hard to find them. One of the ones that infuriated me, and I don't have any names quickly in my head, was a British production of Pajama Game that played in Toronto and then went back for its debut in London. And it had nothing but world famous artists doing the sets, the costumes, the choreography, the music, and most of them had never done a show before.
Oh.
They were a different kind of artist and whatnot, and all of it was completely inappropriate, and it had ridiculous designs that might have been fascinating in a museum but looked awful on the stage, and it was awful. And the only thing in the whole thing, it was badly directed. The woman who did the lead was okay.
Okay.
And all the Canadian critics decided that it was an outdated show that, 7.5 cents... It just couldn't be revived. And a few years later,
Kelly O'Hara and Harry Connick Jr.
Did a beautiful revival in New York that was a smash. And I was so annoyed by that Canadian one. It wasn't really Canadian, it was English in Canada, by how bad it was, because I loved the show. and I didn't think it was in any way dated. That really got under my skin. I've seen lots of bad amateur stuff.
Sure.
Imagine doing a Waiting for Godot and rewriting the dialogue.
Wait. Samuel Beckett is kind of like Albion. Like, I don't want this done to my work. You have to have them in the trash can. Da-da-da. How on earth did they get permission, I guess, to rewrite Waiting for Godot?
I'm sure they didn't.
Oh, okay. That would do it.
They just did it. Figuring, you know, we're out in the sticks. Who knows what we're doing?
They're being Waiting for Fred was actually the name. Just kidding.
Oh, no. He had jokes about Dr. Grabo pipes and things in it. It was really infuriating. We had done a reading of it before it was ever published in English in the U.S. that a friend of mine who was in comparative literature had worked out a translation, and we read it for the graduate students and some of the other students at the University of Maryland before it had been produced in English in the U.S., and everybody loved it.
So you got it. You got it even before seeing it on stage, that it could work, that it was a viable piece of theater, even though, quote-unquote, nothing happens.
You just read it.
Yeah.
Everybody was fascinated and laughing in the right spots and so on. And we weren't even that good actors. We were just people who read it.
Amazing. Well, it has been amazing talking to Herb Simpson, the theater critic. Remember that you can read his Stratford reviews. He's got a few of them already posted at TotalTheater.com, and he'll go back in August and post some more.
Well, my local theater, Jiva, has an excellent director. He's been bringing in really best people from Ireland doing some plays there, and they do some very interesting things.
Cool. So people can read about that as well. I wish you certainly continued good health, if not at this point the best of health, but certainly good health, good travels, good dance, music, and theater. And again, thank you. It's been an honor talking to you on Dave's Gone By. Thanks, Herb.